Hello and welcome. You're listening to RTR FM 92.1. My name is Taylor Strano. It's so great to be with you at just after 11 o'clock on this Tuesday morning. This is Herstory, and if you haven't been here before, it's our weekly look into the lives of some of the most interesting women in WA. They are all inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. Herstory is a project funded partially by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. They're able to help us put this together every week, both on the radio and also in podcast format. If you can't stick around for the next hour, you can go back and listen to the extended conversation in podcast format, wherever you pick them up from. Make sure you subscribe now so you don't miss out each week when we drop an episode. Herstory on RTR FM, Spotify, Apple, and of course our website as well. We're at episode 6 today, and we've already met and spoken with some pretty impressive women, and none more impressive than our next guest, Estelle Blackburn. She's a Walkley award-winning journalist, now based in Canberra, but originally growing up in the state's Wheatbelt region. If her name sounds familiar to you, you might be aware of a 1998 book she published, Broken Lives. Estelle has been credited with exonerating two men from prison who were wrongfully convicted of murders, which were later attributed to serial killer Eric Edgar Cook. Estelle has lived such an interesting life. She's worked for the former Premier Carmen Lawrence. She's also been an investigative journalist and has done some amazing work in exonerating people who are innocent from crimes they did not commit. This is episode 6 of Herstory this week with Estelle Blackburn. Just a heads up, we speak about some pretty heavy topics in this episode. If it stirs up any feelings for you, you can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14.
It took a lot of work. There were a lot of lunches, a lot of bunches of flowers, a lot of tears, a lot of phone calls. Back then, I don't know if you'd say it these days, but there are the three F's of journalism. Find them, F them, and forget them. Because I had begged these women to relive this awful trauma for me, I couldn't forget them. I just had to keep in contact with them. I had brought this out of them. They had given me their stories, relived it, to help John Button and Daryl Beamish, and I couldn't forget them. Several of them have died now, but I'm still friends with them. Whenever I'm able to get to Perth, I visit them and keep up with them. I think it is important to get those stories so that people can understand the ongoing trauma of attacks or any sort of tragedy that they went through. They had buried it deep inside. I raised it to the surface, and very pleased I did for those women, but also for people to understand that personal tragedy that people can live through and have to survive through.
Welcome to Herstory, an RTRFM podcast series exploring the lives, careers and victories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll be with you each week as we hear the stories, trials and tribulations from some of the most interesting women across the state. In episode 6, we get a masterclass in investigative journalism from Estelle Blackburn. A Walkley award-winning journalist, Estelle is well known for her work in exonerating two men from the Eric Edgar Cook trials. Estelle has published several books, including her 1998 well-known title, Broken Lives. She's also been awarded an OAM and been recognised for her contribution to journalism nationwide. Not bad for a girl born and raised in Northam in WA's Wheatbelt region. This is her story.
Estelle Blackburn, journalist and writer.
What are your earliest memories, Estelle?
I had the best childhood, a very fortunate to have a comfortable middle class one. But my very first years, preschool years before six, were in Northam in the country. And that was just delightful. The country space, the fields of dandelions behind us, so my little girlfriend and I could make dandelion chains. My friend had, her mother had a florist, so we'd go down the shop and the gorgeous smell of flowers and waving at the trains as they went by. Dad used to read us, my brother and me, bedtime stories. We had chooks and a pet sheep, lovely little trips for picnics occasionally at Lake Leschenaultia, And on very special occasions, my parents would drive into Perth to watch a movie, and we would sing all the way back. So I know all the World War songs, like Pack Up Your Troubles and I've Got Sixpence and all those silly things. It was just really delightful, with my brother 3 years older than me, and just the sweet, easy country life.
Following Northam, you came back to Perth City and completed the rest of your schooling here. Can you remember a time, Estelle, when you were younger, who you were looking up to or who you were admiring? I'm sure your parents and your mum were definitely some of those people, but were there other people around that you can remember hearing about, maybe on the radio or reading stories about, that you thought were pretty great?
The women I most admired were the three women who gave me my DNA, and maybe talk about them later. But my mother was very active in the women's movement, so perhaps the one I remember most would be Irene Greenwood. And it was absolutely wonderful that I should be inducted the same year as she was. And that was quite a spectacular thing for me, because Irene Greenwood was my mother's role model and therefore somebody I heard a lot about.
Can you tell us a bit about who Irene Greenwood is?
Irene Greenwood was a women's activist, a peace activist. And in fact, she was a radio broadcaster. She did a program for about 6 years, Women on Women. But mostly she was this great activist for peace and for women. And would you believe she had a boat named after her, the MV Irene Greenwood, on the state fleet, the flagship of the state fleet. So you never know, Taylor, you might get a boat named after you sometime.
Oh, look, I wouldn't say no to a boat named after me. I might have to take some ginger nut biscuits on said boat, though.
That sounds like a good idea. But yeah, that sort of women's movement one. Most of my role models, or the people I most admired, came to me later in life. In my childhood, I probably was just having a wonderful time. For primary school, I went to Presbyterian Ladies College. So I had women around me and no thought of inequality. The headmistress was a woman. There was a great feeling of confidence and equal rights and no thought that I was second rate to boys. Perhaps one of the best things about my very early years was that my mother was a commercial teacher. She taught shorthand typing and bookkeeping. And to entertain my brother and me in the long Christmas holidays, she taught us typing. So my brother and I would have races to get to the next lesson first. And to learn to touch type at the age of 10 has been such an advantage to me right through life, right through taking notes for the book I later wrote, writing the book, and now, of course, in writing emails. I feel sorry for the two-finger typist. I can just zip away and type almost faster than I can think.
Such a skill that has not gone to waste as, like, technology has advanced, surely.
That's right, but one that has gone to waste for everybody else but me is shorthand. When I became a cadet at the West Australian, one of the rules was that we had to get to 120 words a minute shorthand before we left our cadetship and was graded. And because my mother was a shorthand teacher, and so all the secret mother notes around the house were written in shorthand, I was thrilled to have the opportunity to learn. We were given an hour a day shorthand lesson at the West Australian where I was a cadet. I was the first to pass my 120 words a minute. That's 2 words a second. And so thanks to that, I was sent up to Parliament House to be on the political team covering Parliament House. Because in those days, you couldn't sit in the press room and listen to recordings or record it. You had to sit on the press bench and take notes of what they were saying and then go in and write your story. So really, the shorthand I learnt at the West Australian, that was at age 18, and the typing I learnt from my mother, in a way, almost set my course, or certainly made it easier once I was investigating an injustice and writing a book.
It's fascinating. I want to talk more about the book and more about your journalism career in a moment, but I find it interesting that Irene Greenwood was one of the people that you mentioned there. Maybe it was a link intended or not, but having her own radio show and also being part of the media, is that something that was always sort of on your radar as a child or throughout high school, that you wanted to maybe pursue a career in reporting?
No, that wasn't. That really, in a way, came as a surprise. Certainly English was my favourite subject. through high school. I loved writing. I joined the pen friend club that the Sunday Times had in those days, and I wrote to so many people all around the world. I had so many pen friends, so a lot of my spare time was writing letters and receiving letters. That let me know about the world, but also how much I enjoyed writing. In the end, one has stuck, a Swedish girl, so I had strong links with Sweden since I was about 14, and I still have. That was nice. That was a big thing of my youth. But probably more, I wanted to do social work. My intention was to become a social worker. So I obviously always felt a need to help people. My paternal grandmother was a Methodist deaconess, as they called them then, now deacon. And when they couldn't get a minister to go to the little Methodist church in Denmark on the south coast, she volunteered and they gave her full rights as a minister, a dog collar and the works. She was a fiery person with definite persuasions, a speaker, a minister. And then my mother too, she was an activist. She was president of Adoption Jigsaw. So I think in my childhood it was more important to do something to help people, and social work seemed the obvious one. So I was heading towards social work. When I went to uni, I especially did the units that would lead to my social work postgraduate degree. But then somehow it just happened that I preferred my writing after all. And unbelievably, because my writing did exonerate two men later in life, in a way I became a social worker to some extent through my writing.
Through storytelling as well. I mean, was that always something that you knew about, the power of journalism, writing and reporting, and how that in itself can be an act almost of social work?
Well, yes, it certainly can be. These days especially, there are more opinion pieces than straight reporting. But yes, I was always very interested. We always listened to the ABC News first thing in the morning in the kitchen over breakfast. Favourite sight of the day, once we were living in Floreat Park in the city, was Dad walking home from the trolley bus. Dad walking up the street, hat on his head, whistling, and the Daily News under his arm. So I'd always rush to get the Daily News and read that. So yes, certainly we can learn a lot from journalism and from writing, and as well books as well as newspapers. And now there are a lot of journalists writing books and making a difference through what they're teaching, what they're instructing via writing. When I won the WA Woman of the Year in the section of arts, I kind of had to explain in my little speech, I'm sure people were wondering, but I was saying that the arts has a great place in justice, how many people learn about injustice through documentaries, through movies and through books. It does have its place where you can talk about that cause without using the legal jargon that a lot of people don't understand.
Providing that missing link between the common or lay folk and those that are really greatly suffering at the hands of the injustice.
Yes, yes.
Tell me a bit about your West Australian cadetship, something that you started post-school. Is it post-uni or was that before you went to university?
Well, I didn't get in the first round. In those days, the West Australian took 12 cadets a year and the ABC took two. Straight after school, I applied and I became 13th. So they offered me a job in the library. So I took that, very pleased to be smelling the ink of the West Australian, even if I wasn't in the newsroom. But the job was filing. The boss would cut out all the stories that should be filed away. And my job was with Clag Glue, finding the right files that these stories should be stuck in and gluing them down. So it wasn't the most exciting job in the world after doing reasonably well at school. I was in the A class and got a few distinctions, etc. So suddenly using Clag Glue to stick stories down wasn't very exciting. And then I got a Commonwealth scholarship to go to uni. You had to pay to go to uni in those days, but a lot of Commonwealth scholarships were given. So I left the library and the Clag Glue and went to uni. And then I applied again after first year uni and got my cadetship. So then I finished university while I was a cadet as well. Luckily, too, in those days, we were allowed 10 hours a week off to go to university. They did encourage the cadet journos to have a wider knowledge of things. We weren't allowed to study English because that was obvious. So we had to study other subjects so that we had the know-how, the background, the context for stories. And I did that. So I finished my degree, my BA, still with the correct units for social work, But by then, I loved journalism, so it was right back to the West.
What year are we talking here about the West?
This is right back in history. I know, I'm 71 now, Taylor. I finished school in 1967, so my first year of full-time uni was 68, and then I started the cadetship in 69. David Brand was the premier, and I remember once I was an older journo saying to the youngsters, oh, David Brand was the premier when I started at Parliament House, and they kind of looked a bit quizzical. Who?
Who's that? Yeah. Can you paint a bit of a picture for us, Estelle? Can you tell us what the state of journalism or news was like when you were first starting out? Who were in the newsrooms in those times?
Nobody any of your listeners would even remember, except perhaps from Brian Burke. Brian Burke was a journalist at the West Australian when I started. He went on later to become Premier of Western Australia back in the mid-80s. There are a couple of women who are possibly well known, but certainly to my generation. That's Geraldine Doogue. She went on to a great journalism career over in the eastern states at the ABC. And Helen Trinker. For our day, Helen Trinker became industrial roundsman at the West, which was quite something for a woman to do the industrial round. And Helen Trinker then moved to Sydney as well, and she's done very well. She's still an associate editor at The Australian. People over here know both of them, but probably in Perth, they're probably reasonably forgotten now. But Geraldine Doogue has a program on RN each Saturday morning.
You said it there just before, Estelle, about the industrial round not necessarily being something that women were usually in the field of. There were very specific ones that were predominantly men, or were there ones that were women's rounds specifically?
Well, as you can probably guess, medical and education generally went to women. That was the thing in those days. And interesting too, although we had equal employment, equal pay in those days, the West Australian got around it by grading the women as D grade and C grade, and grading the men as A grade and B grade. So although we were officially equal pay, there was generally a difference in gradings around it. But sure, to get around, you had to have some expertise, be a bit older, had some experience and expertise. For the general people, and this is how I started, of course, you were just a general reporter. So each day you would get from the chief of staff a list of the stories you were to do that day. And it could be probably maybe about four stories, whereas these days with the 24-hour news, there would be more, of course. If you get maybe four stories, you had to go out and write. And we did a lot of it on foot. We'd go out and see people rather than all by the phone as these days. But a general reporter would just have an array of stories to do each day given by the chief of staff. And you'd become a kind of a jack of all trades. What I found from those years of being a general reporter is I got to know a little bit about a lot of subjects, but I was never an expert in any at that point. And when I do get to speak to journalism classes at universities these days, I do always say you really do need to study something at university, become the expert, so you can be the expert writer, somebody with an opinion whose opinion is appreciated rather than your general person, especially with the 24-hour news. Being a general reporter would be a hard task, I think.
I think about Geoffrey Thomas when you talk about somebody who has sort of an expert or an expertise in a particular subject. He obviously is the go-to for any aviation news or stories or opinion piece and analysis.
He certainly is. And he loved planes right from a little child. He was just aircraft mad, even as a little one. So that one came very, very naturally to him, obviously. He didn't have to, well, I probably did study it very hard in the end, but sure, he is the aviation expert. And I would say nationally as well as West Australian too.
Can you tell us what the difference between general journalism and investigative journalism is?
General journalism, I think, is still hard work, but a bit easier in that most people you approach as a general journalist are happy to answer your questions, to tell their story. People like their 15 minutes of fame, and it's generally nothing controversial. So you ring somebody for a comment on something, or what did you see today, what happened, and they'd be happy to talk. Investigative journalism is going into territory where people don't want to go. So with investigative journalism, you've got to look under the covers, you've got to convince people to talk about something that they might not particularly want to talk about. It takes a lot longer work. You couldn't do 4 stories a day. It would be a much longer job, and it is going to places where people might not want to be taken.
And might not want to answer the questions either.
That's right, exactly. So a lot of it is persuasion, and certainly in my case, it took a lot of persuasion in some areas. Yes, you're ruffling feathers with investigative journalism.
When did investigative journalism become on your radar, and when did that become a thing that you were really curious or keen to get more information about?
Oh, Taylor, only when it hit me for 6, it landed on my lap and turned my life upside down. I was having a very hedonistic life. I was having great fun. I was at that point working in the government. I'd gone to the dark side of journalism, turning out propaganda for the government. But that was well paid, reasonably statused, and quite good fun. All my spare funds and time were spent on dancing and overseas travelling. I was having a wonderful time, and then suddenly this case just fell on my lap. It was a case of John Button claiming that he was innocent of a murder he'd been convicted of 30 years before. He was innocent, and he'd been crying out to each premier, writing to each premier over the years saying, "I am innocent, please reopen my case." Look, I didn't believe him at first. I'd been told that the real killer, the person that had killed his girlfriend, was Eric Edgar Cook, who was a serial killer running around Perth from 1958 till he was apprehended in 63. But we only knew about him from Australia Day 63. And really, I just didn't believe him. I did not believe John Button, but I was a journalist. I was curious, a bit nosy about it, so I just looked into it. And then when it was revealed to me, when I was absolutely certain that John Button was innocent and there'd been a travesty of justice, injustice against him, then I decided I had to do something about it. I was a journalist, a dancer, a traveller, a writer, but suddenly I became an investigative journalist because I had to look into this wrongful conviction from 30-odd years before.
So this happens at a time when you, like you said, are living a bit of a life of luxury. You're doing this work in the West Australian government. You're working specifically for which premier?
I worked, and that was wonderful role modelling for me as well. I worked for the first female premier in Australia, Dr. Carmen Lawrence. And that was wonderful there too, to see what women could do. The first woman premier. So it was an honour to work for her. But also before that, the very first minister I was allocated to was the police minister. And it's amazing how that helped my later career. It's almost between learning typing and shorthand, first as a journo going to the police courts, and then working for the police minister, it was setting me in train for this investigative work to prove that John Button was indeed innocent, and it was Eric Edgar Cook who had murdered his girlfriend. It was all there, but it was certainly wonderful working for Carmen Lawrence, but she lost the next election and the Liberals came in. Each press secretary was taken in and asked, did we want to work for the Liberal government, and I certainly would have. I think it's very important as a journalist and a press secretary to be able to work for either side, not to be influenced by one's own views. But by then, this work for John Button had landed in my lap, so I put up my hand to leave. And I was very lucky with a female boss, a female friend, offered me work at Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital just 2 days a week, so a bit of income while I did this investigative work.
You're working in the Premier's press office when this story falls into your lap. Like you said, this man had been writing to each Premier each time they'd come in and there was a change in government. What was the thing that led you to go, actually, this is something that I need to now devote my time to, and I'm putting my investigative journalism hat on, I'm leaving the PR side of things? What was it about this particular story or this individual that was so intriguing to you?
Look, I was raised to believe in justice. Really was injustice wrongful conviction would never have occurred to me. But in the middle of all of this that I've told you about, I travelled overseas, and I was overseas for 6 years, living in England, when the Irish IRA bombing campaign was on. Groups of people called the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four were finally caught, and hooray, I could breathe. I didn't have to walk the streets of London wondering where the next bomb was going to be. But after I returned to Perth when I was 30, all of those convicted men, the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four, they were all exonerated. And suddenly, my goodness, could they have been innocent? What's this wrongful conviction? And then too, as I arrived back in Australia, Lindy Chamberlain. So Lindy Chamberlain was convicted, and gradually there was the unravelling of that case. So wrongful conviction just kind of permeated my mind. But when I came across this case, I still believed in justice, and I still thought, this is going to be wrong. Thanks to my work for the police minister and knowing Brian Bull, who was then commissioner, I was able to get into the police files for Cook and John Button. And I would say I was the first and probably the last non-police officer to be allowed into such confidential files. So I couldn't have done this work without Police Commissioner Brian Bull and the help of the WA police, certainly. In those files, there was one gotcha moment when I read something there from the detective sergeant who got the confession out of John Button that showed me he was lying. And that was my moment when I became not just a casual nosy journo, well, what's all this about? But then I was determined. I became an investigative journalist. I'm going to get to the bottom of this.
At that time, is it something that you can share with the people in your life and tell them what you're working on? Or were you keeping it a little bit more under wraps because of the nature of the work?
I was told very much there were two rules about writing a book. One was that you never tell anybody what you're doing, or they'll pinch the idea from you. And the other one was, as soon as you do an interview, write it up while it's fresh in your mind. I broke both those rules, and I felt I had to. The second one first, I was dealing with people who were, it was such an old murder, 35 years previously. I was dealing with old people. I had to find people in their 70s, 80s, 90s. And I figured if I was writing up an interview, the next person I wanted to find an interview might be dying. So I didn't. I just kept doing the interviews and then had to go back. Once I'd finished, then I had to reread all my shorthand, re-listen to the tapes. So I broke that rule. But the other one that you're referring to is, no, I did tell everybody because I just spread the word so that I would get stories, so people would come out of the woodwork. Oh, I know that. Oh, heck, etc. So the more I spoke to people, the more stories I got about Eric Edgar Cook himself and more about John Button and help. And these days, I think that's probably what podcasts are about to some extent. And it's wonderful what investigative work is done in podcasts. But again, you're putting it out there each episode, what you're doing. So people are calling in, you're garnering information by getting it out there. This is the case we're looking at. Next episode, next week. That was what I was doing. Certainly everybody knew, and I got a lot of help. A lot of people would tell me stories, and I would find stories around the place as well. But it was a scattergun approach I took. I didn't know who was going to give me the information I needed, how I was going to find it. So I just tried to find everybody I could, tried to talk to everybody I could, certainly listen to everything anybody would tell me.
I guess I asked that question, Estelle, because this is all information that you're sort of uncovering in unprecedented ways, like you mentioned there. Were there people around to support you and to make sure that you were okay? I mean, we talk about it all the time now that when we talk about hefty subjects or pretty dark topics on the radio or in newspapers, that there's usually people waiting in the wings for those who are reporting on that subject matter. Was it like that for you at the time of writing the book?
During my investigation, no. And in fact, I left my then boyfriend once I really had to concentrate on this. I just realised I needed all my energy for myself. So I left and I was on my own. But once I started writing the book, a journalist from the West Australian who then also worked for Carmen Lawrence, Zoltan Kovacs, he just one day said to me, Estelle, you need a book friend. And after that, he was my book friend. So yes, I then got that wonderful support from my book friend, Zoltan, who then became my first editor as well. And then once the book was out, I got a lot of support then from Brett Christian. He's the editor owner of Post Newspapers. In fact, when I couldn't find a publisher, he personally published the book. And then he came in and helped with scientific testing. He just said, courts love science. Let's do some crash tests. And he put a lot of time, effort and funds into getting the scientific crash tests that certainly helped us get over the line in the appeal that my book, the fresh evidence of my book, won for John Button.
I have two questions. The first one is, what is a book friend? Because that sounds delightful. And the second one is, did you know that this was always to be a book when you started unpacking and investigating?
When I first met John Button, he had written a manuscript, and he'd sent this manuscript off to Fremantle Press and got a very nice letter saying, look, it was well done as far as it was done, but it would need a lot more work before it would be publishable. And John was holding his head in his hands. He's a religious man, saying, oh God, I need some help with this. If ever I'm going to get justice in my lifetime, I've put everything I can into this. And at that moment, he says, but he's probably romancing a bit, at that moment he got a call from his brother, who knew what I was doing, and said, hey, John, are you writing a book or something? I've got some journo bird interested in your story. So I had his manuscript to work from, and I first went into this thinking, well, I'll just edit his manuscript, or do maybe 3 months it'll take me to do something for somebody else. But I could see his manuscript was all about his pain in prison on a wrongful conviction. And I could see instantly that nobody's going to worry about you if you're hurting in prison for a crime you did. I'd had to be turned around and I had to find the evidence that showed he was innocent. So I had to start again. But it was clearly going to be another manuscript to replace his. So yes, it was a book all along, but yes, I agree. Isn't book friend a delightful phrase? That was one concocted by Dalton. It was just, he speaks very quietly. Estelle, I think you need a book friend. I will be your book friend. It was very lovely.
Is this somebody who you just were able to check in with while writing the book, or is this someone who swapped book recommendations with you?
I guess really what he was for me was then a shoulder. He lived in Cottesloe and I was in Mosman Park, and we'd go for walks along the beach and talk things through. So he was my support. He did recommend some books. Yes, he did. There was a couple that particularly helped me with ideas. But it was more a shoulder to talk through where I was getting to. Best advice he ever gave me, and this is where he was a true book friend in just guiding me along the way, I had all this research into Cook. I knew more about Cook than anybody, even his wife, I dare to say, because I had managed to get access to every single government file on Cook, as well as the police file, his prison file, his medical file, his legal file, his mental file. I knew everything about Cook at that theoretical level. And my first draft of the book I'd written in straight journalism. But Zoltan said, Estelle, you are the expert on Cook. You have the right to interpret him. Don't just write it as plain fact. Write it as interpreting him, understanding him. So that was a great help. And, of course, some of his family members don't like that idea. How dare you pretend to know what our father was thinking? But I had all his confessions. I had his whole life story as told by him to the police. I had things that his wife did not know about. There were crimes he had committed that his wife, who became a friend of mine, Sally Cook, she died last year, but Sally became a friend. I took her everywhere I could go to go through files. So I was an expert on Cook, and I turned him into a living, breathing person instead of just a name on the page, thanks to Zoltan's advice.
It's that really good skill that good journalists and good investigative reporters have of being able to humanise a topic or a person while still relaying facts. Through all of your reporting and through all of your career, having experience obviously in journalism and in politics and in PR, legally though, no legal background, what was it like to navigate legal jargon that has to obviously go hand in hand with the work that you did?
Yes, I think that's one of the amazing things that a journo with no legal training whatsoever was able to overturn John Button's conviction and a connected conviction after that, Daryl Beamish's. But John Button and Daryl Beamish had both lost a combined 7 appeals. And yet I was able to find the fresh evidence that gave them a new appeal 40 years later. So yes, that was difficult, and I didn't know very much, but I did befriend a lot of the people that I interviewed. One was a former Chief Justice, and he would give me some guidance as well. But yes, one of the advantages of writing the way I did, or again how the arts can help the legal system, is I could just write it in normal speak, not legal speak, so people could answer it better. But one mistake I did have, when Button's case was lost in the High Court, I headed the chapter, the 82-minute case, believing that was absolutely dreadful, what short time the High Court gave John Button's appeal. And once we were going into an appeal into the legal side of it rather than the writing side of it, and two wonderful lawyers offered their services pro bono for free, Jonathan Davies as solicitor and Tom Percy as barrister, Tom Percy looked at me and said, "Estelle, 82 minutes is a long time in the High Court. They're usually given 20 minutes, if that." So there's one major mistake I made.
You mentioned there a little bit about the family being a bit of a naysayer. Were there other people telling you this is something that you couldn't do or an area that you shouldn't be wading into? Or was the reception quite arms wide open and quite encouraging?
Yes, everybody was, because your listeners probably won't know so much, but Cook was a big name in West Australia, in Perth people's lives. I was 13, first year high school at Methodist Ladies College. Cook became known to us on Australia Day in 1963 when he shot 5 people in one night. So Sleepy Hollow, safe little country town Perth, changed overnight. And that was 2 weeks before I started high school. So for anybody my age or older, Cook was just, my God, what a character, what a mystery, what a horror you're delving into, but how wonderful to learn more about him. All people knew about him was what was covered in the papers at the time, what he did say about himself at his trial, but nothing like the depth that I knew. People were terrified but intrigued by Cook. The only naysayer I had was when I had all my information and I was writing the book, my brother was a psychiatrist, and he would always say so often, "Estelle, it's time to write, full stop, the end." It was always, "Estelle," I think he was worried about exactly what being surrounded by murder and necrophilia and mayhem, what it was doing to me psychologically. I'm certain, dear bro, that's what he was worried about. But it was always, now it's time for full stop, the end. You know when you've written what you need to write. So I had to keep going, of course.
It's interesting you bring your brother up here being a psychiatrist, and something that maybe people don't consider if they don't work in these areas or know somebody who is a reporter or a journalist in their own lives is the emotional toll that it can sometimes take on people to be constantly exposed to heartache and hardship. How do you recover from working on particularly hard cases in these demanding situations? I mean, this one fell into your lap and it's something that you were obviously hooked on to see through to the end. During it, how do you go about making sure that you're all right and you're in check with all the things that you're being exposed to constantly?
That's a very good point. A lot of journalists suffer from that, but also first responders. One of the stories I had to cover for the ABC was a school bus crash at Meriden. And had to go up to that and talk to parents. And that was something that I found it very difficult to get through. And that was just one. There are so many journalists covering so many horrors that I don't know how they do it, but I just know it's important they do. For me, there's a double me. One is a very serious justice crusader. The other is an eccentric. I love country western music. I love dancing. I love Irish music. So I would always have that to get back to life and good spirits. So I had that going on in my life at the same time.
It's really an interesting point that you raise about the idea and the responsibility, I guess, of a journalist who has to be face to face with those things. It's a matter of necessity, I guess. We talk about the death knock at journalism school quite a lot, of that painful thing that people don't really want to go through, and nothing really quite prepares you for it. But it is, because it needs to be reported on, the idea of knocking on the door of people who've just lost a loved one or have been caught up in a tragedy of some kind. It raises that question of, is it actually necessary, and where does the role of reporting have its place in Australia? And Estelle, I'd love to get your thoughts on it. How do you feel about reporting on those controversial or painful topics? Are they necessary?
I think they are. First off, people are curious and interested, but we're one community, we're one group of people. For the death knock that the poor police cope with, but the knock on the door of somebody to get their story, there is a role for it. There is a role for having people gain empathy, to know, to understand. If they haven't been through that terrible experience themselves, then it's a part of world knowledge to understand better how it is for people who have been through it. There is a story to tell. Also, it does give the poor bereaved person the opportunity to tell us about the person who's died as well. It gives honour and understanding, gives life back a little to that person who's died. Tragedy is part of life and part of humanity, and if we're going to ignore it, if journalists, reporters aren't going to be brave enough to write about it, then there's a whole aspect of life that the rest of us who have been fortunate enough not to suffer it miss out on. It is an important role, but it has to be done very, very carefully. And look, I had quite a bit of that in writing the book. There were 12 women who were attacked by Cook and managed to survive. And those women, much as when Cook confessed, the police checked it all out and agreed that it was Cook who had attacked them and tried to kill them, they never announced it publicly. We West Australians did not know till I came along with my book about these poor women who suffered terribly from Cook attacks. I believed the important thing that I had to do was find these women, talk to them, get their stories to show that Cook, who said absolutely in a very detailed confession that he had run down John Button's girlfriend, and John Button was innocent, and he had run down 7 other young women in similar attacks, but that was never known about. So I had to find, a very laborious task, to find women in different states, different countries, and different surnames. In those days, you changed your name when you married. And managing to find them through quite some foot-slogging effort, then I had that call, will you tell me about this trauma that you lived through 30-odd years ago? And, of course, they had packed it away. They'd got on with life. Most of them married, had children. That was deep down within them, to ask them to relive it, bring it all up again, what happened to them, the emotion, the trauma, the months and months and months in hospital, in agony. I had that job as well. And it was difficult, but good on them. One of them lived in the Whitsundays, and she was the one who couldn't do it, said, I can't do this. So one thing about investigative journalism is never saying no for an answer. So I flew to the Whitsundays, knocked on her door, and said, oh, Sister Blackburn, look, I was just passing through. Could I just explain how important this is? So, yes, that face-to-face contact won me her story, and it was very awful for her. All of these women were very badly injured for a long time, and she had 3 little children she couldn't look after, etc. But funny, when her husband later drove me to the airport, he said, now, Estelle, next time you just happen to be passing through, give us some warning and we'll organise to have you to dinner.
That is commitment to get this story.
Once I found those 7 who had been run down, I wasn't doing this for Daryl Beamish, because his family said they didn't want any help. They didn't want this raised again. But I always knew if I had success for John Button, it would flow on to Daryl Beamish naturally. So once I did manage to get these 7 women, that one in Whitsunday was the last, I needed her, I needed the full pack, decided to find 5 women who were attacked in bed, the same way that Gillian Brewer, Beamish's so-called victim, was killed. I thought, well, I'm writing the full story, the life of cook for the first time, I actually need all of them. So then I had to find five women who'd been attacked in bed as well. One had died, but I got her story another way, but four of them. One of them, I had to fly to New Zealand to talk to her, but Cook was strangling her in her bed, and she semi-woke up. She was within one twist of death, I would say. Something woke her up, and she started fighting a bit. So then he got a stocking from her bathroom and tied her arm to the top of the bed and was setting about to rape her when something happened to avoid it. Now, she couldn't live in Perth. She had to leave Perth with that trauma. So certainly approaching her was very, very difficult. But in the end, I found her married in New Zealand, married to a man who never believed her. He always said that sort of thing didn't happen in sleepy, hollow little Perth. You either invited that man in and changed your mind, or you're making it up entirely. So going there to see her, able, thanks to the police, to be able to take Cook's confession to her case and the others, the husband had to believe her. They went to counselling, and a wonderful success of this work is she divorced him. And the nice part of the story is she came back to WA after that and married a guy from her hometown and is now happily married and living back in Perth, which she had fled out of her terror.
This can be largely attributed to your work in getting the story. Does it go to show how important journalism can be in shaping the community perception of survivors of abuse and violence?
Well, yes, indeed. They certainly weren't known about. And I guess at that point, I hadn't experienced it. I didn't know about it either. So to be able to get this from them, it took a lot of work. There were a lot of lunches, a lot of bunches of flowers, a lot of tears, a lot of phone calls. Back then, I don't know if you'd do it, say it these days, but there are the three F's of journalism: find them, F them, and forget them. Because I had begged these women to relive this awful trauma for me, I couldn't forget them. I just had to keep in contact with them. I had brought this out of them. They had given me their stories, relived it, to help John Button and Daryl Beamish, and I couldn't forget them. Several of them have died now, but I'm still friends with them. One of them came to Canberra and visited me a couple of months ago. Whenever I'm able to get to Perth, I visit them and keep up with them. I think it is important to get those stories so that people can understand the ongoing trauma of attacks or any sort of tragedy that they went through. They had buried it deep inside. I raised it to the surface, and very pleased I did for those women, but also for people to understand that sort of personal tragedy that people can live through and have to survive through.
The notion of the three F's is really quite alarming and quite gross, to be honest. I'm really glad that that's something that, at least in my time, I haven't come across that. So I hope that's something that is dying out, that notion.
I think it has. And that was an expression first used to me by a male journo, and I did feel that generally, and this is a dreadful generalisation, the men were a bit tougher and like that particular journo who first used it to me, but then I learnt about it later from several sources. I had a car crash and I had an awful scar on my forehead, and everybody, when I came back to the ABC, everybody was just not looking at it, but he just came up to me, plain speaking bloke, he said, "Oh no, Estelle, you can't have that ugly thing on your forehead, you've got to get to a plastic surgeon." He was a very plain speaker.
Can imagine that so many people were lining up to give him their confessions. After 13 years of authorship and public speaking and crusading for justice, you've moved to Canberra to take up full-time work again. Why did you make that move to Canberra, and what have you found yourself doing over there?
I did work 2 days a week during all of this, and I sold my investment house to fund this work. It took 6 years to research and write the book, and another four for John Button to be exonerated, and then another three again for Daryl Beamish. And I got these wonderful lawyers prepared to work pro bono, but I did a lot of the ordinary old work for them. I still couldn't work full time till we got it through the court cases. So I had impoverished myself. There was a lot of trips, a lot of photocopies, a lot of, as I said, just getting on with life. The photocopying, the mail, the lunches, the everything you had to do took it out of me. Mind you, it enriched me in every other way. I'm saying I was impoverished by this work, but certainly enriched. I felt I had fulfilled a purpose in life and made a difference, so I'm very happy about it. But I then realised once it was all over, I needed to earn a living again. And in Perth then, I had a bit of notoriety, really. I was known for it. There was a fair bit of publicity at the time. And I figured if I'm ever going to just earn an ordinary old living again as an ordinary old person, I am an ordinary old person. It just happened that at that time I did something extraordinary, I suppose. But if I'm going to just earn a living as a quiet little unknown person, I can't be in Perth. So I came to Canberra because it's a small city. I think the little girl from Northam would find it a bit difficult to live in Melbourne or Sydney. So I managed, from Perth, I managed to get a job in Canberra. I was 60 then. I just figured, well, I'll work for 5 years full-time, save as much as I can. But by the time I turned 65, nobody was saying, you're too old to work. So I kept working till last year, till 70. And I did gain enough to buy myself a little townhouse here. Canberra, for the size of it, Canberra, because it has the National Folk Festival every Easter. I would come from Perth to Canberra for the Folk Festival and have to camp. Canberra at Easter is a bit cooler than Perth, so I would absolutely freeze in my tent. And the thought of being able at the Folk Festival to go home to a warm bed was enticing. But it was that, the Folk Festival, but also perhaps more the size. And luckily I was able to get a job here.
I just want to change pace for a moment very quickly. As part of this podcast, Estelle, we also play part of this on RTRFM on our radio station. And with that comes music and musical selection. We've asked all of the inductees that we've spoken to if they can give us maybe an artist or a song that they absolutely love and cherish and would like to hear on the radio. I imagine yours might be something in the folk realm.
You're right. Any song I would choose would immediately put a big click on your radio station. I've been listening to you and I know it's very, very young. So yes, look, anything folk, country and western, or that's now called country, folk, country, Irish. I quite enjoy lots of hymns, interestingly, as well, but any of those would do. Tom Percy, he's Tom and Jonathan, played in an Irish band while I was doing all this. So I used to go to their Irish gigs. For one, I was able to ask them what's the next thing I should do in this case. But also I was able to just join in and learn Irish songs. Anything Irish would be wonderful.
Before we wrap up, we're going to speak a little bit more about the Hall of Fame in a moment, but you've been given the WA Clarion Award for the greatest contribution to journalism, also the Premier's Award for non-fiction writing, numerous journalism awards. When you got the call to say, we'd like to induct you into the Women's Hall of Fame back in 2011, what was that experience like?
Absolutely surprising, and really I thought they must mean my mother. She was an activist and she got an Order of Australia medal. She was out there, she was crusading on lots of fronts, and I thought, you must mean my mother. So when it did turn out to be me, I was absolutely delighted, of course. Well, really thrilled, honoured of course, but just straight thrilled. It's nice to have accolades from various groups, from people, but for women particularly, to be in the Women's Hall of Fame, my goodness. The year I was inducted, not only then did I join Carmen Lawrence and Irene Greenwood, but two other ministers I had previously been press secretaries for as well, Kay Hallahan and Yvonne Henderson. So there were three wonderful women who I had previously worked for in there, given the honour the same year as me, and that was something quite amazing. As I said, I had lots of women role models. I went to an all-girls school. I never felt that I was unequal, and yet I was very aware of the need for women's rights. All those activists who had worked for them, gone out of their way, sacrificed a lot. So to be part of that, where there's so many people, and I noticed this year there's lots of women from way back, there's First Nations women, there's refugee women. To be bundled in with extraordinary women is fabulous.
The name of this podcast is Herstory, an RTRFM podcast, having a look at some of the inductees of the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. Have you heard that word Herstory before, Estelle?
Look, I haven't heard that before you. I think it is just wonderful. And I do think that the changes in language are helpful too. This last week, batsman's becoming batter and things like that. Long time ago, chairman became chair or chairperson. I do think there is a growing acceptance that gender shouldn't be an issue in terms. But sure, her story is very clever. I congratulate you on being very innovative and clever. It's quite lovely.
Oh, we cannot take credit for the word, but we'll take it, absolutely. Tell me about writing your memoir.
That's right. You asked me what I was doing in Canberra, as well as doing the day job that was earning me a living. I did continue to work on cases in my own time. So in a way, I had two jobs, the day job and my real job, which was investigative. So right now, I'm writing a writing memoir about how I wrote Broken Lives, exactly that, how a journalist with no legal training can have that success. I'm calling it Writing Broken Lives, W-R-I-T-I-N-G, with a double entendre. Boasted behind that is writing, R-I-G-H-T, because I want to get the how I did it, but also what it achieved. I'm also working on two other cases, a wrongfully convicted guy from a Sydney murder. He's in prison, and I'm trying desperately to do the same again and get him out of prison. And also, I'm trying to prove the innocence of a West Australian pilot who was officially flying a plane that crashed in Canberra in 1940, killing Australia's war cabinet, and a crash that ended up changing the government from Menzies to West Australian Curtin in the Second World War. I'm trying to get up a documentary to show that he was not flying at the time, and his death led to the suicide of his wife and his family. I just like that, righted for the sake of his family, although he died 80 years ago. So they're keeping me busy, those three projects.
You know, when I ask that question, most people say, oh, I've retired. I'm just, you know, spending time with my family. I'm taking it easy. You're doing just three simple projects that are so extraordinary.
Oh, look, I hope I succeed with them. And I managed to get myself a little two-day-a-week job as a guide at the High Court.
Oh, stop it.
So when West Australian school groups come over and I'm talking to these school groups, I wear my Hall of Fame badge, that lovely little map of Western Australia. That's on my lapel, and I hope little West Australian kids notice it and say, hey, she's one of us.
Estelle, thank you so much for your time. I so wholly appreciate it, and I actually cannot wait until we get to read your memoir when it does eventually get to see the light of day.
Oh, you're gorgeous, Taylor. I'll send you one, and I look forward to reading yours too. You've got a stellar career on the way. I already know, but I'll be watching you from now on.
Oh, thanks. I think you'd be waiting quite a while till anything exciting happens.
Well, I never had a radio program.
Oh, Estelle, thank you so much. Thanks to Estelle Blackburn and all the women at the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. And thank you to all the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Courtney Withers, Fiona Bartholomeus and Sophie Minisale are the assistant producers. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RCRFM podcast series about women in the WA Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll catch you next week for Episode 7.